Okay, let's share your stories. Marjorie Sandor with us as we talk about her edited version of her book, The Uncanny Reader, Stories from the Shadows. Marjorie, you seem to have a good mixture of men and women in terms of their short stories. But particularly, I mean, who seems to write the more horror story, the man or the woman?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. I think that men and women write, I guess I don't know. I think of,
Who would have the most macabre?
Domestic horror. Like, I think Shirley Jackson, for instance, has a fantastic sense of how Swiffery can be a horror story. and then some of the men in the collection, I think, Ambrose Bierce. Have you ever read any Ambrose Bierce?
Yes.
It's his story is set in San Francisco in the late 1800s, or actually a little earlier, and it has a very noirish feeling. So it's a lot of, dark, slick city streets and a pair of twins, and one of them has committed a murder, and the other one isn't sure which of them committed it. So I can't make any generalities about it, but I do think that there's some spectacular stories in this collection that have to do with home interiors and suburbs, and some of them are written by women, and I think maybe those particular writers have a particular sense of how the suburbs and sort of domestic life can really be holding secrets.
All right, back to the phones we go. Let's go to Kahana on the Big Island of Hawaii. Hello there, Kahana. Go ahead, please.
Well, hi, George.
Howdy.
Good to talk to you, and hi, Marjorie.
Hello.
I read a story as a kid called The Willows, and I wondered if you'd heard of it, read it.
Who is it by?
It was so, well, it was, I believe, it was in an anthology of stories that I seem to associate the name Bennett Cerf with, but he didn't write the story. And it takes place, the fearsome character is a river, actually.
Ah.
And it made me think of old times when people were afraid of forests. As when I did environmental work, one of the reasons that was brought forth that people would cut down too many trees is they were afraid of them.
Right, right. And what the forest holds.
So now we're afraid of suburbia.
Right, now we're afraid of suburbia. That's right, now that we've cut down the trees. You know,
if you can find it, it was so terrifying. I had to close the book in the middle. I just was shaking. I seem to remember. I was
the
just
willow.
So frightened. I just wanted to pull myself out of that.
Ugh.
And when you were talking about the difference between movies and reading, I realized that the movies will give me nightmares, but the books won't. When I saw Eraserhead, just one image, you're talking about that valley.
The Uncanny Valley?
The there's a woman in it that has weird things on her jaws.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, that's right.
And I would see that in my dreams for 10 years, fully 10 years after I saw that. So I really backed off on seeing scary movies. I just didn't like my sleep disturbed.
Right. Well, that was a powerful image. It worked, right? It worked.
You can find The Willows.
I will. I look forward
seems
to finding
to be,
it. I think, your idea about the forest is really important. There's an actual, sort of a really old architectural theory that what makes us feel best in our houses is prospect and refuge. We like our backs to be safely against something, but we like to be able to see out, across the plains or the lake or whatever to see our enemies coming. We don't really like that enclosure in front of us. So I think you're onto something primitive and powerful there.
Marjorie, you've got some Edgar Allan Poe stories. How would you rate him with the others?
He's awesome. He's so great. He was such a great, great writer, and he influenced so many writers afterwards. So I'd rate him extremely highly. He still excites students. I always teach him right at the beginning of my literature courses, and people just go nuts for him. It never fails.
Telltale Heart.
The Black Cat, The
Classics.
Cask of Amontillado. Oh, so great. The Mask of the Red Death. He's the best.
Wonder how prolific they'd be if they had word processors and computers and
You know,
things
that
like
guy
that.
worked so hard, too. He was
Oh my
always
God.
in debt and struggling, and he was an editor and a reviewer, and he wrote all these great stories.
Do
And
you
then he
think
died young.
they made more money after they died?
Of course.
Yeah.
Everybody dies penniless,
People
most
buy
great
their
writers.
books and everything. Let's go to Reba in Washington. Welcome to the program, Reba. Go ahead.
Well, I am happy to be able to get on. I have to tell you, when I heard you mention Shirley Jackson, it was like I couldn't believe it, because so many times I have discussed books with friends and they say, "Shirley who?" And I'm going, if you haven't read Shirley Jackson,
You
you
haven't
haven't
lived.
read. And I started reading her when I was quite young, and I read all of her books, and I was totally distraught when I found out that she had died. And how she died was in a car accident. And it
No,
was
tell me
actually her husband and her best friend that finished her last book. She had written quite a bit of this one book, but it had no ending, and they didn't know what the ending was supposed to be. So they actually finished the book for her. And but yeah, and I attribute my love of reading, because I probably read about 30 books every winter, and it snows a lot here. So I probably read quite a few, you know, at least 30 books every winter. And
Good for you.
but I attribute my love of reading to Shirley Jackson. I also love Daphne du Maurier,
Oh yes,
and
Rebecca.
yeah,
She's a great
and
writer.
it's like, you know, there I have so many favorite authors, but
Yeah.
I wanted to thank you so much, and it's like I can't wait to get your book.
Great. Well, I'm thrilled. I'm glad to hear about another Shirley Jackson fan. I think she's coming back now, and her children are very wonderfully curating new collections all the time. So keep your eyes open. There are new collections coming, I think, next year of works that were previously unpublished or buried in that Library of Congress archive. So
Marjorie,
you have more to look forward to.
how many of your writers are still alive?
Oh, bunch of them. Let's see.
That's good.
Oh, I'd say, you know, could be 20, 15.
20 of the
Yeah,
31? That's pretty
15,
good.
15 to 20, I'd say.
Oh,
About
hit
eight
us up with
now.
another favorite story. Give us one more.
Oh, let me think
I'm
here.
making you work for
You
this
are making me
tomorrow.
work for my supper.
How about that? Well, you're only going to sell a million
Okay,
books because of the
this one's
show.
a little, this one's a little, oh, it's a little upsetting. I hate to do this to you. No, I'm not going to go there. Okay, The
You're not going there.
Jesters by Joyce Carol Oates
The
is one that I would bring
Jesters?
up. This is
Okay.
the suburban one where there's an older couple living in a cul-de-sac in a gated community, and they start hearing sounds from a house through the woods, neighbors through the trees, they call them, and they sound very young. But as the days go on, the summer days go on, they start hearing more disturbing sounds of gunfire and shouts and anger and a baby crying and a little child
Huh.
crying. And it just gets worse and worse till finally they're driven to drive around the cul-de-sac to the other identical cul-de-sac. So it's like the houses are doppelgangers of each other.
Huh.
And as this goes on, and the couple starts to uncover their own sort of fractures in their relationship and their own you know, their own buried secrets. But what's really great is when they come around to the other side, the house is abandoned and has police tape in front of it. It hasn't been lived in for some time, and apparently there was a fire there. And the story actually goes on a little bit further. I won't spoil the ending, but it's a wonderful sort of treatment of houses as having character and life in them, and that the suburbs, you know, and the sort of perfectly contained areas actually still are sinister.
What do you think makes a house haunted?
I think that houses hold our stories, and they're sort of, it's almost like the walls are holding the stories. and all the history of the places, so the things that have happened there. So I think it's our knowledge or our sense that other lives have been there before us. And if you just even hear a tiny bit of a story of a house, you start to imagine the lives that went on before. In all the really great old ghost stories, there's always an old housekeeper or a grandmother or a nanny.
Who knows something.
And the new members of the family don't know it or have repressed it. But she knows, and she will tell the youngest member of the family. So it's really great sort of mythic stuff of that houses and the elderly hold the truth that we are so afraid of.
Well, it's fascinating in terms of, these ancient houses. I don't think of new houses as being haunted.
No, but they can be, even if, I don't know, I had a friend who lived in a house that a murder had been committed in, and it was only a 10-year-old house.
Yeah, that's not old at all.
It's not old at all, but they couldn't stay there. They felt like the house itself was toxic. And there were certain parts of the house that felt worse than other parts.
Bad karma.
They left.
Let's go to Christine, Fairbanks, Alaska. First-time caller. Hello, Christine. Go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I'm enjoying tonight. I happened to be reading Edgar Allan Poe yesterday.
Oh, what story?
Mask of the Red Death and the Oval Portrait.
Oh, that's great.
And a couple others, but they said in the prologue that he is the father of science fiction and the father of mysteries.
And a detective story.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, when you were talking about how eerie sounds and dolls can be, I remembered that when our son was just under 2 years old, we were visiting my mom in the Detroit area, and she brought up from the basement a very realistic doll. It stood a couple inches taller than our boy.
Oh, God.
And it had brown eyes that were very real-looking and even eyelashes that were made with the stiff hair. And she had a real smiling face, and we urged Corey to come over and meet this new little friend and to play. So he happily approached her. They both had outstretched arms. But the instant his hand contacted her face, he was terrified. He just spun around screaming and bolted right out of the room.
Wow. He thought she was real.
Yeah, and he
Maybe
knew
she
that
was.
He was freaked out by the discrepancy between what he expected and the cold, hard face he felt.
Oh, that's a good story.
You're a wonderful
Is he all right now?
Pardon?
Is he okay?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, he's working late. It's, past midnight here at work, and he's listening to this on his radio.
Oh.
Going, don't say it. Don't say that story.
Oh, tell it.
And you've heard about myths, right? The truck driver who picks up the woman in white.
Right.
And she wants to be dropped off at a cemetery and kind of disappears and
right.
stuff like that. Are those stories enough to carry into a short story or a book? And some of them are based on legends, aren't they?
Oh, that's such a great question. I think they are if there's something else going on for the writer with them. I mean, I think those kinds of things sort of form the foundation and the material, but there has to be some wonderful, weird sort of psychological disturbance that is also on the writer's mind to really make that myth bloom again for us as contemporary readers. I think all the great stories of even right now, the great stories are all underlain by myths. I was even thinking of, I can't remember which caller was talking about a story, but it was the one about the boy who gets the doll or the little mummified child thing from the graveyard of the Indians, right?
Mm-hmm.
Takes it home.
Right.
And that to me sounded like one of those great old stories of temptation and curse, right? The oldest, it's the oldest myth we have is the idea that we are tempted, we pick the apple, and then we are flung into the mortal realm. We pay the consequence of that. This idea of curiosity and the curse that follows. And I think that's just the deepest, oldest, greatest form of human storytelling we have. And it's up to us as contemporary writers to figure out what in contemporary life actually still bears that same quality, right? How do we make it contemporary and ancient at the same time?
Do any of these stories, Marjorie, end happy?
Happy.
Are they all tragic?
Not necessarily tragic, but sometimes they end in a moment of new knowledge that is in itself transcendent and kind of terrifying, but also thrilling. There's a kind of moment of growth for the character who has broken through some limit that they had before. So I guess happy probably no.
I knew it. Let's go to Ernie, truck driving in Maryland. Ernie, welcome to the program, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, George. I'm honored. I listen every night.
Thank you, Ernie. Appreciate it.
And I'm from Michigan, and I got to tell you about a ghost story about that happened at our house there.
Okay.
We bought this property from these old ladies, and we put this mobile home on it. And the kids, they were 4 years old. You know, we were like the poor newly married couple, you know. And I'd come home from work, and like the faucet would be on, or the refrigerator be open, and I'd tell the kids, turn that water off or shut the refrigerator. And they'd say, well, we didn't do it, Dad. The trailer ghost. And everything was the trailer ghost did this. The trailer ghost did that.
Great title.
And I just go, yeah, okay, you know. And then they said, well, there's an Indian boy that lives in the hallway. Haven't you seen him? And I said, no, you know. And I'd have to take him down the hall to use the bathroom because they'd be afraid to go down the hall to use the bathroom. And the cat would look down the hall like there was something down there, you know, and he'd kind of move around real weird like. And so years later, the kids, they kind of outgrew it, you know, and we were building our dream home behind the trailer. And the neighbor guy, he was the old guy that, you know, retired, and he'd lived there all of his life in the neighborhood there. He come over when we were building the house, and so I put him to work. And we stopped to take a break. I'm nervous as hell. But anyway, he said, you know, you built your house right on the old Indian burial ground.
Oh, man.
That'll do it.
And I said, no. I said, when we dug the basement, we didn't see no sign of anything. But he says, there's the big rock. Where's it at? You pound on the big rock, and the chief shouts up at you and says, who's up there? And I said, well, I buried it.
Oh, that's great. So here's this is a fantastic example of that thing we've been talking about where the old person has the history, knows the sort of history of the land.
That's right.
Right? And
big difference.
There's this amazing moment where the new young family sort of learns what they didn't know before. Like that should have been hidden has come out into the open.
I don't think I'd want to live over a cemetery.
We lived
Would you?
In Florida in an old town called Micanopy, named for Chief Micanopy. There was a woodworker who lived in the house just in front of us, and he used to say, oh, you know, this whole town is over an Indian graveyard, and there was a great battle near here, and it used to just spook us.
All right, we're going to come back and spook you even more with some final stories on Coast to Coast AM. Well, come on out to the Greater Toronto Area on August 22nd. We've got a live stage show event. Looking forward to that. Full information by going to events at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you along with Marjorie Sandor and your phone calls as well. Marjorie, of these writers that you selected, you didn't take their top stories,
right?
I guess because everybody knows them. Did you want to just take the other stories?
Yes, I'm never a fan of repeating anything that other people have done. And a lot
right.
of stories have been anthologized half to death, you know?
Yes, right.
So I, and as a kind of principle, I did want to seek out the lesser known stories of the famous and then lesser known writers themselves. to kind of mix it up and get some new writers into people's view. But it was particularly a lot of fun to sort of fly in the face of the usual and choose stories by, say, I have a piece by Franz Kafka. Usually in anthologies, you'll see his famous story about the guy who wakes up to discover that he's been turned into a giant bug, Metamorphosis, or a couple of others.
Well, have we lost you too? I think we have lost all our phone lines, folks. We'll try to see if we can get her back. Who knows what is happening? Who knows what is happening? We might have to end up running a tape, folks. I think our entire phone system is down. Everything is, well, hold on now. Tommy's talking in my ear. I'm millions of miles away from him. So let's see if, Jeff, if you get her, just pop her back up, if you would. But definitely having some technical issues here back in Los Angeles. You got her back there, guys? Nope, you don't have her? Okay. Well, some problems indeed. If not, we'll just have a great little time and talk a little bit. Everything's done? Nothing? No phones? Everybody's gone? Tommy, talk to me, would you? Everything's gone. The whole system is down, and my phone system is down as well. So we can't do that. The guest is gone. The calls are gone. And so, Jeff, you might as well just run that little tape until the end of the show. And if she comes back, so be it. Do you have it?
But the reaction was inappropriate, and but there was no Secret Service attempt to kill John Kennedy. That's the glare you see in the sun. It's been thoroughly studied.
Ken is in Houston now. He's to the Rockies. Go ahead, Ken. Thank you.
Good evening.
Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, can you hear us, Kenny? We're talking to Jerry Corsi and taking calls about his book on JFK, by the way.
George, you interviewed an author of Dr. Mary's Monkey some time back. Remember that?
A long time ago, yes.
And there was some mention of Oswald in his book, and to the fact that when he was in the Dallas police station, he was hollering that he was, or I say hollering, he was making the statement that he was set up, he was a patsy for this. And in this book, it goes into it, he was working for a government agency back then, and working as a chauffeur for one of the doctors.
Yeah, that was one of Jim Mars's works, Jerry.
Yes, it was Judith Barry Baker, who also wrote a book called Me and Lee. She came out later into the whole issue, and her books are very interesting and very convincing. I'm not sure that they're fully documented. There's two problems. You know, she came out late, and there may be a good deal of invention in what she says. Secondly, if you do take seriously the work done by Armstrong on the two Oswalds, and I think there's a good case to be made that the government agencies were substituting an alternative identity in, at times, representing to be Oswald. Certainly that's the case in the trip to Mexico, which we have not had time to discuss, but it's hard to say which Oswald that was, if in fact the relationship was there. At any rate, the idea that Oswald was saying he was a patsy is actually on film during one of the clips when Oswald's being taken through the halls of the Dallas
That's
Police
right.
Department. He does say on camera, I'm just a patsy.
I'm just a patsy. He sure did. You know, when we were talking about those who supported Hitler,
yes.
When we finally went to war with the Nazis, what
yes.
did they do, those supporters?
Well, in fact, some of them continued to support Hitler and had to be shut down by Franklin Roosevelt, including the founding fathers of the Bush family and the Dulles family and their investment banker friends in Union Bank operating in the United States as a Nazi bank. Alan Dulles went to Bern, Switzerland, and continued to work with the Nazis. The United States did not want to go to war against the Nazis. We went to war against the Japanese. Hitler declared war on the United States. And the business interests between the United States and Nazi Germany continued during the war, such that Alan Dulles, starting in 1943, was working with Bormann, number two to Hitler, Hitler's secretary, to move money into the U.S. stock market, to move money into Argentina. And there were even attempts to negotiate an end to the war, except that Hitler would not accept an end to the war, and the United States pressed for unconditional surrender. So the Dulles family made the best to salvage the pieces. We brought Nazi scientists here in the Operation Paperclip. We helped Nazis escape. We top Nazis. And we brought the Galen organization, the Gestapo, that was investigating a secret police for Hitler, the Russians. We made them one of the pillars around which we built the CIA. I've argued that we, in many ways, became the Nazis at the end of the war.
Well, we probably have. I mean, that whole situation is abominable. Some of them should have been arrested for treason.
And we lied about it. I've searched in the archives. I've written about it. I wrote about it when I wrote The Great Oil Conspiracy, how many of the Nazis making synthetic oil we brought into the United States after the war. And the files say, this guy's still a Nazi. He hasn't changed. And we brought them into the United States anyway. We wanted their technical knowledge. We overlooked Wernher von Braun, the space program and the missile program that they had built, the V-2, and Wernher von Braun knew it and participated in it with Jewish slave labor in concentration camps. Countless numbers of people who died building those missiles in Jewish concentration camps of the Holocaust, which is one of the great human tragedies of all time. And yet we forgave that and overlooked it because we wanted Wernher von Braun and his rocket team to help us with our space program and our intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Let's go to Los Angeles. Hello, Rita.
And we lied to the American people, too, about it. That's what
Yes, hi.
Hi, Rita.
Thank you for taking my call. By the way, I am calling you literally right across the street, unfortunately, where Bobby Kennedy got assassinated.
Yes.
What used to be the Ambassador Hotel.
But
I too, was calling to remark about this video that I saw on YouTube, but I want to break it down in a little more detail, if I may. I think it's very clear, at least in the footage that I had studied and looked at many times over, you could clearly see the limo driver turn back around, kind of, it almost looked like he was aiming his shot, and then turn his head straight, and then a second later you see a gun come out on the side of his face, and then that's when Kennedy's head goes back. And then the other thing that was kind of interesting about that happening right before it happened, I noticed the governor in the front seat leaning over. At first he turns his body, and then he leans all the way into his wife or whoever the woman was beside him, as if to, you know, not be hit, like he knew that was going to happen. So both of those things I just thought were pretty remarkable when I viewed this video so many times.
Yes, that film has been studied extensively, and the driver did not have a gun, and the driver in the Secret Service did not kill Jack Kennedy. It's a reflection of the sun on the hair of the Secret Service agent sitting next to him. It looks like a gun. It's not. It has been studied. And Governor Connally was not aware of the assassination attempt. He maintained he was hit by a different bullet than hit Jack Kennedy in his throat and his back. And it was a second shot that Connally thought hit him. But Connally was a victim in the shooting, just as Jack Kennedy was. So I know that video looks very convincing, but you have to do some research on it. You'll find that it has been debunked, and the Secret Service is not complicit in having pulled out a weapon and shot Jack Kennedy. It did not happen.
Jerry, did you hear about this latest book that came out a few weeks ago, that Kennedy was not the target of this assassination?
No, I haven't heard that, but that, again, makes no sense at all. I mean,
no.
Jack, there were three attempts to kill Jack Kennedy in November 1963. We've discussed them. They've been fully documented, including references in the House assassination investigation. a book by Waldron and Tom Hartman. Several books have fully documented this and excellent research. They were all done with a patsy. They were all aimed at killing Jack Kennedy. They were all plotted by a combination of the CIA and the mob. The third attempt worked in Dallas. The other two did not work. They failed and were called off.
They had probably three plans then, didn't they?
Yes, but the three plans were very similar, and the patsies were all very similar. They were all ex-military. They were all about the same age. They were all going to be identified as shooters with a high-powered rifle and a scope from a tall building on the motorcade. There were the modus operandi of the Dallas killing was the same in the unsuccessful attempt in Chicago and in Tampa, and modeled after the Guatemala coup d'etat that was engineered by E. Howard Hunt and the CIA in 1954 and 1957.
Let's go to Lake Oswego in Oregon. John's with us, first-time caller. Hey, John, go ahead.
I have one comment and one question for the guest.
Sure thing.
My question is, was not Richard Nixon in Dallas before JFK's plane landed? And he was talking, I can't remember who he was talking to, and he left real quick. And my question and my comment is that on the third shot, when John Kennedy got hit in the head, all the splatter went behind and his head went back. Now, I shoot guns, I've shot deer, everything else. He was shot from the front. There, I mean, anybody that has any experience in shooting a rifle knows how that works. The bullet goes in small and comes out big.
Yeah, that's true. It's amazing.
We agree. Headshot, I think there was a double headshot, one from the back almost simultaneously with one from the front, but the shot from the front happened second, and it did. Was an entrance wound from the front and an exit wound out the back of Jack Kennedy's head, and it did throw him violently to the left back on the seat. That was a shot from the front, and it was recognized as such at Dallas Hospital, at Dallas Parkland Hospital. Also, I do discuss at length in the book that Richard Nixon was in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. He was there to supposedly attend a soft drink convention where he was working with the company. And Nixon lied about it. He left after the assassination, and I make the argument in the book that Nixon was aware of the assassination plot, was there, and benefited from it. Within days, Nixon was holding a political meeting with his top advisors in New York, deciding, now that Jack Kennedy was dead, how did that advantage his next attempt to run for the presidency?
Exactly. And he elected, of course, not to run in 64.
Yes.
But he came out in 68.
And Jack Kennedy being eliminated the major rival that Nixon would have faced. And Nixon did not want to run against Johnson, who was going to be representing the martyred president. It was going to be very hard to beat Johnson after the assassination in 64.
That's right.
And Nixon thought he'd bide his time and run the next time, which he did, and he ran successfully.
That's right. Hubert Humphrey, right?
With Hubert Humphrey in 1968.
Let's go to Doug in Richland, Washington. Welcome to the program, Doug. Go ahead.
Hello, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Corsi, you're one of my favorite guests, and I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
I would like to share with you, I've tried and tried and tried to call whenever you've had a JFK assassination night to share a non-scientific realization on my part of how I decided that, personally, that Lee Harvey Oswald never even pulled a trigger.
All right, go for it.
In 1994, I found myself, it's a long story, but I'm going to make it completely short. I found myself on what they called the sixth floor. That is the schoolbook depository with it all being modernized, and they've got amazing things there and a maze that you go through and everything else. about halfway through, you find yourself near the corner of the building next to the window that supposedly Lee Harvey Oswald shot from his sniper's nest. You can't get to that corner exactly, but you can stand about 8 feet away, one window away from it, and look down into the street.
Right.
Well, I found myself there looking down into the street and imagining myself as a sniper. It was a beautiful day. There were cars. There were convertibles going down the street. And I have hunted all my life, shot small animals, big animals, the whole nine yards. And I am looking down there, and I am imagining a car going away from me on what I think they call LBJ Freeway. That's Elm Street, I believe.
Elm Street, yes.
In any case, after a few minutes, I realized that that is virtually an impossible shot.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. Jerry, we are rapidly out of time. Good luck with this work, and thank you for allowing us to be the exclusive on your presentation.
I really appreciate it, George. It's the first interview of any national significance in the book, and I want to commend you for all the years in which you and Coast to Coast have brought more information to the American public on the JFK assassination than anyone else, in my opinion, in media, with some historic programs, including the one with Hunt St. John, St. John Hunt, where you broadcast the first time the deathbed confession of E. Howard Hunt. You've just done magnificent work on this, George, and I'm honored to be with you tonight.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much. Jerry Corsi, name of the book, of course, Who Really Killed Kennedy? And, of course, during the assassination around November 22nd, we'll, of course, do a assassination program for you as well. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safer.